I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Just when you think you know what makes cities tick, something changes. Population, the economy, technology. So the question, what makes cities work, never gets old, and it's never been more important. Ken Corey and Mark Wilson have taken a deep look at the global knowledge economy, how it is reshaping cities, and how urban planners ought to respond. Jay Wall Jasper takes a more down-home approach, urging all of us to just get out and do it ourselves when it comes to improving the places we live. We'll talk with them about changes global and local affecting our communities today on Smart City, right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Ken Corey is professor in the Department of Geography and the Urban Regional Planning Program of Michigan State University. Mark Wilson is associate professor in the Urban and Regional Planning Program at Michigan State. Together, they are co-authors of Urban and Regional Technology Planning, Planning Practice in the Global Knowledge Economy. Ken, tell me, what is the significance of information and knowledge in today's economy?
A multiple set of responses would be possible, but I think the thing that is so exciting is the instantaneous global networking and communication that is possible because of these new technologies. And that in turn just spawns a whole variety of different development opportunities that we've never really had until these technologies came online.
And give me an example of what some of those opportunities would be.
Well, I guess one of the sectors that has been most impacted and has taken full advantage of these networking technologies has been in the financial services, banking, industries that, as you, for example, watch the stock markets go up and down and watch the sun move around the earth with the Tokyo Stock Exchange moving to Paris, moving to New York, you see this instantaneous kind of response that can occur both globally and then as each of those continents might have a different reaction to whatever is going on economically in the world at that time, then they may respond differently and not become part of the herd. But the herd mentality and these electronic communications in the financial services sector in particular is one that, as you know, we've all been quite worried about, both as individual investors as well as from the point of view of national assets as well.
Mark, Ken has described an economy that is global, clearly global and instantaneous, and yet there are big chunks of the economy based on services, based on experiences that are still quite grounded in place. So, and in the local. So, how as a planner or an urban decision maker do you operate simultaneously on that, both that global, on the global stage and plan for that and that opportunity and take advantage of that opportunity and not lose or overlook opportunities that may be simply local?
Well, I think services form on a spectrum. And at one end, you have services that require presence, like getting your hair cut. There's no way you can outsource that. At the other end of the spectrum is any type of product that can be undertaken electronically. And so Ken mentioned financial services. We have call centers that are operating globally. And so on each end, we have something that has to be in a place, and at the other end, something that can be anywhere. This is very footloose. And in the middle, we have a range of services that are often hybrids. So you may go to visit your doctor, which has to be done locally, but, say, reading x-rays may be done at a distant hospital where there is greater expertise. So I think what it asks planners to do is to really understand the nature of the economic activities in their city or their region, because they're changing. And every few years, it's appropriate to go and revisit the way the businesses in your community operate, because they may well have changed how they source, how they operate. And that knowledge, I think, will inform planners as to how they see and plan cities of the future.
Mark, in effect, you're asking planners to go out and look at what is today's reality. And yet, as you point out, things are changing so quickly. How can planners get ahead of the curve? And I'm using planners, but in fact, we're all invested as citizens, as taxpayers, in what planners do. So to some extent, they represent us all. If they want to be intentional about creating the best opportunities for thriving in this kind of world, then what should they be looking for, or what process do they use to point them in a future direction that, again, amplifies the best and diminishes the worst?
I think that was one of the reasons we developed our model, which we called the ALERT model, and it has different elements to it. And one element, the A in the model, is awareness. And we find ourselves in this position, I think everyone does, of being surprised where your prior knowledge is proven wrong. That you read a newspaper story and say, oh, I didn't realize that had changed, or my point of view from college or something I learned 10 years ago no longer fits. So I think we are in a rapidly changing economy, and the knowledge gained 5 or 10 years ago needs to be refreshed. And in refreshing, we make confirm what we always thought, but we may also discover that there are new conditions, new forces shaping our community or our businesses. And so all of us can benefit from revisiting our assumptions of saying, let me take a day and check into the facts. Let me go and find data, collect information to confirm what I thought, or to remind myself that things have changed and I need to change as well.
Ken, Mark has begun to describe the ALERT model that you've put forward in your book, Urban and Regional Technology Planning. I want to give you a chance to go ahead and sort of briefly go through that model for us so that we don't leave it simply at awareness and the first letter.
Okay. As we constructed it, it's an acronym. So as Mark indicated, A really stands for awareness, and the key outcome that one needs to derive from that activity is understanding your local context, your cities or the region surrounding your city's context in that global economy, which, as we indicated before, is helped out and linked through these IT networks that we've identified. The L for ALERT is standing for layers. And layers, as we're using it, can be relatively complex, but it consists of at least three sort of dimensions. One is sort of a spatial or locational kind of layer, and we're all used to that kind of layering from local government to state government to national to, in effect, global kinds of linkages. Another dimension, the second dimension, is temporal. We actually mentioned that a little bit before when we were talking about the sort of rolling 24-hour stock market linkages. That's a kind of time frame that until relatively recently, I think most of us really weren't particularly on top of and using that time frame unless we were in the stock market. The third dimension is a substantive or a content dimension, and that can involve a whole variety of mostly, as we've constructed in the book, mostly economic functions that are production in nature or consumption in nature or quality of life and amenities in nature. Again, another three-part dimension. And that really leads us into the third component, the E, which we've constructed it to mean e-business or electronic business. And what we've done is construct a spectrum a range of these various kinds of businesses, some of which are purely economic, some of which are social, cultural, and economic, all of which are facilitated by some degree of electronic and information technology means. And as Mark indicated before, some of those electronic means are hybrid, meaning non-electronic and electronic. But in effect, then, this new networking set of technologies facilitates a whole variety of new business opportunities, some of which exist presently and can be improved or made more productive by automation, for example. Some of these opportunities are still yet to be invented. For example, in the last few years, social networking has emerged where just less than a decade ago, relatively little of that kind of phenomenon existed. The R in alert stands for responsiveness. And this is relatively straightforward, at least conceptually. You might think of it in terms of two particular kinds of responses that could emerge. One, sort of an economic or a demand response. What is society at the local level and even at in global markets? What is the marketplace saying it demands? The other dimension is, of course, more social welfare or looking into the kind of needs that society often manifests, and particularly in capitalist societies where there often are disparities or unevenness in the kind of opportunities and development that exists throughout the territory of a particular market, one often needs to be concerned about having access to sort of gaps in that capitalist marketplace. The last component, the T in the alert model, stands for talk. And we intentionally used the talk notion because it suggests that if you look at the other side of the coin, maybe we're not in society today doing as much communication, including talking, as we might in order to take full advantage of these network opportunities. And so talk then ends up being an opportunity for us to not only talk about what problems we have had, what problems we currently have, but as you earlier asked in the conversation, what about looking into the future? And this is where planners traditionally have had sort of an advantage because some of the training that planners have focuses on the future and encourages us to take a look at not only projections or forecasts, but maybe those kinds of futures that we desire and are driven by the kind of needs and demands that were in that earlier responsiveness stage. Now, lastly, I would say that I rank these or sequence these A-L-E-R-T sort of in phases, but once one has engaged each of these activities, then one can cross rough and interact not necessarily in a linear sequence. So as I say, initially, one might want to follow that kind of sequence. But once one has begun to put these components together, then one can move around through those stages I mentioned before of that are temporal, yes, but also spatial when we talked about disparities and, of course, are driven by these various urban and regional functions, as Mark indicated, are heavily changing, but some aren't. So that here we're based in Michigan and manufacturing has been so important in the economic history of our state. And even though there's been a lot of decline in our manufacturing sector, it's still a very important sector and still lends itself to enhanced productivity by these various technologies.
Mark, let me ask you a question. Do you think mid-sized cities are at a disadvantage in a knowledge economy?
No, not necessarily. It depends upon what the mid-sized city has, so what its current economic base is. It depends on its educational infrastructure. And by that, I don't mean that you have to have a major research university. A good set of colleges or community colleges can launch you in a knowledge economy as well. But part of what a medium-sized city needs is leadership. It needs vision. It needs to have a motivated governance structure where a priority is placed on understanding change, on understanding what the city can and cannot achieve, on working with the community to reach those goals of creating a shared vision. So I don't think it's a matter of size. In fact, medium cities may have advantages in terms of quality of life, cost of living advantages compared to major cities. So there can be many pluses for medium cities that they need to harness. They need to recognize those advantages and to work with them.
I want to ask you about something you just said. You said it's important for them to understand what they can and cannot achieve. It seems to me, looking at the economic development plans of many communities, they're sort of built on wishful thinking or, what the other city did, and they're not terribly mindful or insightful about their own assets and their own capabilities, given the context, the current context of again a global economy. I'm curious how you think communities can gain that insight into what they can and cannot achieve.
Well, part of this is the awareness factor, and part of it is the seduction of, say, the Science Park or Silicon Valley. But we have a Silicon Valley. It's already there. It's not moving. And so to think that you can replicate it is unlikely. So there's a dose of realism here, of understanding what you can and cannot do. And that means that you need to assess the resources. Maybe look at making some strategic investments, working at the state level to, say, get extra funding for education or K-12 help or community college or local colleges. What's within the realm of short-term possibility rather than perhaps an unrealistic expectation that you'll replicate Silicon Valley? Part of our very early research we conducted in Ireland. And that country was highly motivated to become a high-tech center. And one of the early goals was to develop the software industry. And as a byproduct of developing the infrastructure for software, they realized that call centers would also work. And in fact, for a while, call centers were the dominant user of these new technologies. And they were fast enough to realize that their initial expectation of a large software industry would take longer to develop. And so they turned their attention to developing the call center market that they had. So that's an example of a place that had lofty goals, but it adjusted them as conditions changed. Now it has both a call center and a software industry. But you can see that they went in with goals of a very advanced industry. But it took longer than they expected. In the meantime, they leveraged what they could do to provide employment, which is one of the key goals that local communities are trying to achieve.
Mark, if you were given the job, if you were given the task of developing the economic development plan for a mid-sized community in America, let's say that is in the ranks in the bottom 50 of the top 100 metros. Where would you begin to make investments? You've said education's important. You've said vision is important. You've talked about deep local knowledge. What else would you do?
Well, I think that you touched on education, and I think that's crucial. And education is always difficult because people are mobile. And
so you educate them here and they're not necessarily going to stay here.
That's right. But, in terms of the social benefit of that, there is still a social benefit. You have taken someone and given them skills. And if they leave, then hopefully they'll come back. If they have the education, then you are building an infrastructure around that education. So to me, That is one of the most crucial things you can do. One of the distinctions we make about education also is that there is often, when discussing the knowledge economy, a focus on sort of PhDs and researchers and advanced industries and advanced applications. And to us, that's far too narrow a definition. For us, when you talk about a knowledge economy, you talk about from pregnancy onwards, which means how do you treat mothers, how do you treat families, infants, children, K-12, college, community college, continuing education. So it's not just, is our city producing the scientists that will revolutionize the auto industry? That's way too narrow. Taking a long-term vision and saying, are we providing the maximum support for every person in our community to gain the education they need? Then you're looking at broader issues like health and well-being of individuals, as well as what you teach them. So to me, a good starting point is a broad view of education that cares for the people from the youngest age, with a key to their welfare.
And Mark, at some point, obviously that makes sense. On the other hand, does San Jose, Oakland, San Francisco metro area in fact have the best K through 12 education system in the country, in the world?
Well, one of the things that is often forgotten is that you don't have to get very far from Silicon Valley to find great grinding poverty. One of the interesting distinctions is that we often see cities as wholes. So we'll talk about Metro Detroit, when they're in fact made up of pieces. And the same with San Francisco. Dozens, if not more, local jurisdictions, all of which have different sets of qualities. And so when we look at Detroit and we say, well, as a metropolitan area, it's doing well, we cover up the fact that there are, in a very short distances, there are great gulfs in opportunity and economic well-being. So part of it is the spread of the benefits. And in our book, we always note that you go into a knowledge economy acknowledging that there are costs and benefits. And one of the goals is to minimize the harm you can do by distancing people, that not only focusing on the high end, the benefit end, but realizing that some will be disadvantaged. How can we minimize the impacts of disadvantage? As part of our work, we were participating in a study of Michigan. And in particular, our concern was, what does a high-tech or a knowledge economy mean for distressed communities? Because in some ways, they can be bypassed by a high-tech community because it doesn't have the resources that are currently valued. And one of our realizations is that proximity is very important.
Yes.
And that the knowledge economy employs a lot of people of all skill levels. And
the people who make money in the knowledge economy then buy services and
exactly.
Also, you know, food and so forth and so on. So again, if you're poor or lacking in skills, you'd rather be in a robust economy than one with no opportunity, right?
Yes,
yeah.
but that also speaks to access as well, because if you're 15 miles from Silicon Valley and it takes 2 hours to get there, you may not even find that getting a job there will help you. And so the challenges of many communities is that where the wealth is generated is distance from where the jobs are needed. And it's connecting that geographic mismatch that is one of the challenges of policy and what your medium city can do. Medium cities don't have those huge distances to deal with. They can have those looking for work near those who have the resources to spend, either businesses or individuals. That isolation is still a problem in the knowledge economy, especially if knowledge industries and knowledge workers are very driven by quality of life and amenity, and they're seeking environments that push them further and further away from the center of the city or to smaller towns that are somewhat isolated for quality of life benefits, then you're increasing the gulf.
Yes. Well, this was a fun conversation. Mark, Ken, I want to thank you both for being our guest on Smart City. Their book is Urban and Regional Technology Planning, Planning Practice in the Global Knowledge Economy. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, it's great to join you.
Thank you, Carol.
Ken Corey and Mark Wilson are co-authors of Urban and Regional Technology Planning, Planning Practice in the Global Knowledge Economy. Planet is an assistant editor. Nate Berg has the latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development.
The federal government recently announced more than $800 million worth of grants to help cities build toll roads and enact other measures to reduce traffic congestion. But an article from the New York Times shows that this is only one of two faces the government has in regards to traffic congestion. A provision in the federal tax code lets commuters claim up to $215 per month to pay to park at work. That amounts to about $1,000 per year for each of the 400,000 drivers who make the tax claim. So while the government's $800 million in new grants is aimed at getting more people off the road, it's giving nearly $400 million worth of tax breaks that do exactly the opposite, by making it even more desirable to drive to work. Meanwhile, in Aspen, Colorado, city officials are trying to do what they can to encourage more people to get off the roads. But they're taking a slightly unconventional approach, and one that is making some local commuters a little mad. The Aspen Daily News reports that despite increasingly heavy congestion on a two-lane highway that leads into the city, transit officials have no plans for highway expansion. In fact, they hope that congestion gets even worse. Then, they say, more people will see the benefit of taking advantage of the region's public transit system and park and ride lots. But some commuters say the no-action proposal will have no positive effect on the highway's congestion and will only serve to inconvenience a lot of drivers. And in suburban Atlanta, another unconventional approach is being taken. Four neighborhoods have successfully gained independence from the city of Atlanta over the last 2 years. But in these new cities, there are no city halls and hardly any public employees. Each of them has elected to outsource the vast majority of public government services to a single private firm, making these cities the country's most closely watched experiments in public administration. The extent of this firm's role varies by city, but includes the administration of city tax and revenue collection, public works, community development, planning, and zoning. Some worry, however, that the firm will be too efficient at enforcing city codes, and that will discourage revenue growth. But others in the relatively affluent new town say enforcing codes to achieve the city's vision should take precedence over increasing revenue. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of Planetizen. After a short break, we'll talk to Jay Waljasper, former editor of Utney Reader and now executive editor of Ode Magazine, about great neighborhoods. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Jay Waljasper is author of The Great Neighborhood Book, A Do-It-Yourself Guide to Placemaking. For many years, Jay was editor of Utney Reader and is now executive editor of Ode Magazine. Jay lives in Minneapolis. Jay, what were you hoping to accomplish with this book, The Great Neighborhood Book?
Well, I think that neighborhoods is one of those institutions in our society that sometimes is underrated. I think people often, when they think of solving problems, and they can big problems or even little problems, don't think about doing them on the neighborhood level. So I just wanted to kind of give a shot in the arm to neighborhoods as a great way to tackle problems, environmental problems, social problems, economic problems. And sure, it's small. Neighborhoods are small. But when you add it all together, it can be something really quite empowering.
One of the things I like about your book is that you work really hard to encourage people to start somewhere. Just do what they can do and not worry about what they can't do. That really appeals to me. When you were collecting stories of neighborhood-driven improvement strategies, which one stood out for you as being the most catalytic?
Well, you know, there's one story that's toward the front of the book that I found myself talking about more and more when I'm discussing these ideas with people. And it's the guy in the suburbs of Toronto, kind of a nondescript 60s, 70s suburbs, that decided to put a bench in his front yard and didn't cost a lot of money. He was a little nervous about what his neighbors would think. And this bench, this simple bench, transformed his neighborhood. Suddenly, there were a lot more people out taking walks. Older people were suddenly scooting around the block again because they had a place to stop and rest along the way. You know, kids thought it was kind of a cool place to hang out. And before long, a number of his other neighbors, who he'd been worried about, what would they think of this bench, were putting out benches of their own. So something really that simple, that inexpensive, that something that doesn't take a zoning variance, made a huge difference in this one community.
Let's talk about the potential downside of that. I've come home several times recently to Memphis and found people sleeping on the sidewalk in front of my home. You know, what about the downside of the bench or the potential downside?
Well, that was exactly the thing that Dave Mariachi in Mississauga, Ontario, worried about. And in his case, the outcome was happy. You know, probably a bench isn't the solution for every neighborhood, or at least other problems need to be attended first. And then once you've solved some of the more bigger prickly social problems, then you can stick a bench out. So you have to use common sense in what's going to make a difference and what, you know, might create further problems. I mean, a lot of the problems in our culture are the yesterday's solutions didn't quite work out. So you have to be very careful. One of the things that I stress a lot in this book, and it's also a theme of Project for Public Spaces with whom I wrote the book, is that the community are the experts many times on the place that they happen to live. So if you have a public meeting and you bring up the idea of benches, you know, drawing on the collective wisdom of those people, you'll have a pretty good sense whether your neighborhood would be the place to put in a bench or whether maybe that's something for farther down the line and want you to attend to other problems first.
In fact, I want to talk with you about this notion that the community is the expert. It's the first of 11 principles of placemaking that you mm-hmm. include in your book. The places, the people living and working in a place are the folks who know what needs to be done and how best to do it, you write, which sounds good. And intuitively, you know, you go, that makes sense. But history shows, and you know this, Jay, that a lot of people don't want people of different races or different incomes living near them. If they're homeowners, they may not want renters nearby. So do you really believe that the community is always the expert?
Well, you know, that's sort of goes to the core of a lot of deep-seated feelings in our culture. And those are particularly, you know, race and class are particularly tricky questions. But I think on an awful lot of factors, an awful lot of situations, really it does make sense to draw on what the people in the community think. Because, you know, if you're talking, if you want a place to become a popular place, if you want a place to become a place where people want to hang out, where people want to be, you don't come in and sort of impose something on the community that doesn't quite fit with what they are looking for. Now, of course, race, class, other tricky things like that have to be kind of factored in. So it's not like the community is the supreme judge on all things. But I think what happens, I think, more often in our culture is that the community is just completely not consulted on things. And oftentimes you have a lot of development projects that don't work, parks that are half empty, business streets that aren't thriving because the people could have actually come in and helped with some solutions and they simply weren't consulted or were consulted so late in the game that it becomes kind of a reactive thing. And I think that might be what you often get when you get a group full of people complaining about renters or having thinly veiled racial prejudices. It's oftentimes they've been brought in to a process at some point to essentially approve something that's already going down the road. And that usually doesn't bring out the best wisdom in the community, but brings out the worst aspect of we're scared, we're nervous, we're anxious, and we're just going to say no, we're going to stop it. And sometimes the worst instincts are going to come out.
Mm. Well, I've actually seen the opposite, where those things are actually written into the charter or the land use documents, and so that people know very well before they ever buy what they're getting into. And sometimes I think that I completely agree with your point about the community being consulted as a valuable, important, early source of information. But I also think there are these difficulties sometimes that we have to be aware of. Another one, it seems to me, and I'd love your thoughts on this.
Sure.
My experience tells me that people only know what they know. They only know what they've seen. And so if people, don't you think professionals or people with exposure to a wider variety of options have something important to contribute to any placemaking assignment?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think then it really becomes a question of how the professionals approach it. Rather than saying, here's what you folks should do, the professionals say, here's what's been done in one place, here's what's been done in another place, here are some examples, here's a slideshow. And that brings people into the project, and they're not just simply sort of rubber stamping something that someone else has has already come up with, but they are actually feeling like they're participating in the creation of it. A classic example, and this was something that I researched pretty extensively, there's a neighborhood in Roxbury, which is a rough and tumble part of Boston, called the Dudley Street neighborhood. And there was a foundation that it was literally the dumps. There were a lot of illegal garbage transfer stations in this area, and so these people were living with other people's garbage. and someone said, foundation said, we got to come in, we got to do something about this. And so they came in with all these plans what they were going to do. And the people said, we actually have a different idea. We want to be more involved. And they held a series of community meetings. And this is a very poor neighborhood, immigrant, African-American, high unemployment rate, drugs, drug problems. I mean, it's your basically rough and tough neighborhood. And through this series of these community meetings, a charrette you might call them, people actually had very advanced ideas of what they were looking for without quite using the terminology. They were looking for something that architects frequently invoke as a urban village. And usually, as you know, when people are dealing with poor neighborhoods, it's kind of, let's just do the affordable housing. Let's do it as functional as we can do it. And these people were really standing up and saying, we want gardens. We want the housing to look like the older housing in the neighborhood, not just feel like it's something that was transported from Mars in the middle of this neighborhood, which a lot of public housing, a lot of affordable housing is like. So I thought there was a level of sophistication on the part of these people who've had no training in architecture, no training in urban studies or anything like that, but they simply had kind of a gut instinct about what made a good neighborhood, which just happened to kind of coincide with what the prevailing ideas were in the more enlightened sectors of the design professions. So that was a powerful experience to talk to these people and to see the results of that.
You mentioned public housing, and one of the things I've noticed is that as we've torn down public housing and tried to replace it in urban areas, often it seems the architecture, the design of the new housing is much better suited to a suburban setting than an urban setting. As you look at neighborhoods around the country, Jay, are you seeing any of that? And what's your response to that?
Well, I've seen that not just with affordable housing projects, but unfortunately sometimes with upscale housing projects. And I think part of the problem is the developers oftentimes have a little bit of a cookie-cutter model that they're working with. And so they're throwing up townhouses out in the outer suburban reaches. And so suddenly the inner cities become more fashionable. Let's build something close to downtown. So instead of looking at the classic urban forms of architecture, they just kind of throw up the stuff that they're used to putting up because that's simpler and cheaper. We have a case of that really quite expensive housing development right on the Mississippi River, right next to downtown Minneapolis. And it really does look like it belongs out in the land of strip malls and outback steakhouses. I think developers, they don't change overnight. But I also have seen some projects here in the Twin Cities and in other places that I've been kind of poking around that are gradually really beginning to get it. And what they're building really fits in with the best of the old architecture that was in those neighborhoods. And also not just simply architecture, but also how these developments, how they face the street, how they interact with the rest of the neighborhood themselves. So I think that's a good sign. I think there's a lot of positives in that direction. And in fact, here in Minneapolis, they, under a court order, tore down some public housing. It wasn't high-rise public housing. It was kind of low-rise public housing, but it was still kind of grim. And they put in a new development that actually is really quite an attractive, gorgeous place. And the buildings echo the really fine architecture in the neighborhoods around that. There's a lot of open spaces. There's kind of a stream through it. There's bike paths. And the buildings themselves are just look like a place you'd want to live. And so that was a good sign that I was very happy to see.
That is a good sign. You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Jay Waljasper. He's the author of the great neighborhood book, A Do-It-Yourself Guide to Placemaking. Jay, many of us have been part of neighborhood improvement efforts, add a bench, add a bike rack, plant flowers, clean up, only to see things return to normal.
Yeah.
not a good normal, but normal soon thereafter. The effort really has no lasting impact. What is the difference between activity that is just activity and activity that has a long-term impact?
Well, I think a couple things come leaping into my mind with that question. And the first is simply a big mistake that neighborhoods make, as well as people doing projects on higher levels than that, is they tend to put almost no thought into what happens the day after the ribbon cutting. It's all focused on the design. It's all focused on the construction. And very little thought is put into managing that space, if it's a public space, or managing whatever space that happens to be. And that's a very important theme in this book, in Project for Public Spaces work, and really just common sense, that for a project to succeed, you can't just simply build it, but you have to really pay attention to how you're going to maintain it, how you're going to have it evolve, how you're going to change it around to sort of fit changing needs. And that's really one important thing. And again, the second thing I think that makes a difference is, again, what we were talking about before, the maybe somewhat controversial idea of getting buy-in from the people who live in the place, first of all, before you set forth on a project. And I think that's really where the kind of the wisdom and desires of the community make a sense. If it meets the needs that they really feel that need to be met in their neighborhood, then that's going to be a more popular place than it's just something that someone else thinks, oh, this is a really good idea for that neighborhood. But my book is actually full of a lot of stories where people have rolled up their sleeves, sat down and, you know, made a difference in their own neighborhood. And that's had a really lasting impact, and almost kind of a domino effect in a positive sense, that suddenly someone plants a bunch of flowers in a vacant lot, and then suddenly the business next door gussies up their storefront, and then another business comes in into the empty storefront beyond that. So there can be the kind of collective positive response to someone just simply saying, let's make some changes here.
I especially appreciate your short chapter on drawing attention to what's special about where you live. Tell me about the examples you found.
Well, I think there's examples really everywhere. But, I mean, it's really easy for us. There's, you know, the great beautiful neighborhoods, or the neighborhoods people that are lucky enough to live on a lake or a stream or a river or something. And a lot of us can't afford to live in those neighborhoods. And we kind of feel like our neighborhood, well, it's just an ordinary neighborhood. But, you know, there's something unique and special about every neighborhood. There's a neighborhood in North Carolina that happens to have a lot of great oak trees. So they drew attention to that. There's a neighborhood here in Minneapolis, I actually used to live there, that has a really great collection of used bookstores. There's, you know, nothing otherwise particularly special about it. It's near a university, of course. So they kind of draw attention to the fact that they're kind of this used bookstore mecca. And, you know, it could be a great sports team. It could be simply anything that kind of animates a little bit of excitement. I even use the word patriotism about your neighborhood. And really, it doesn't have to be something fancy. It doesn't have to be something that's just going to be, oh, wow. It can just be a simple fact that the people in your own neighborhood are proud about something. And that kind of helps boost everything.
You also urge people to buy local. And if you put your advocacy aside for a minute, what do you see promising on this front?
Buying local?
Yeah.
Well, I think we're living in a period right now in a lot of ways, but even on the neighborhood level, of sort of countervailing trends. I mean, we have the big boxes, and they are accounting. I think Walmart accounts for 10% of all retail sales in the United States. I mean, all retail sales. I mean, that's an amazing, verging on a monopoly in a way. But at the same time, I see an awful lot of new neighborhood businesses sprouting up right here in Minneapolis. I've lived in my house about 15 years, which corresponds to the great big box epic in American life. And yet, I think probably four or five coffee shops have opened up within walking distance of my house. There's three bakeries that have opened up. There are a number of places, the kind of wine bars that have opened up. And this isn't a particularly yuppie neighborhood. But I think but it's a very neighborhood-minded neighborhood. And it's a neighborhood where people love to walk, people love to ride their bikes. people have a real pride in our neighborhoods. And so I think that's made a difference. And it is immeasurably made my life more fun and more satisfying. And sure, the glass of wine I buy at the wine bar next to my house is probably going to cost me a little more than if I went to Houlihan's or something down by the freeway. But it's my neighborhood wine bar. It's where I run into my neighbors. And it's the same thing with the bakery. It's the same thing, you know, and it's oftentimes a quality sort of replacing quantity in what people think are important.
Let me ask you this, though, and I struggle with this because I too love local businesses, locally owned businesses, independent businesses, unique businesses. On the other hand, I mean, in some ways, it's every business owner's aspiration to be successful, to grow bigger, to have more locations where they're no longer local. Wouldn't you want that for your local wine bar owner?
Well, you know, there have been a couple cases where someone has had a very successful there was sort of a wine bar, French bistro that was extremely successful, and they opened up a second business, you know, in a neighborhood that was, you know, maybe about a mile away. You know, and both of those businesses thrived. So I think it depends how you approach it. I think the person that starts a local business is probably not an empire builder, or they would be doing something else. I think oftentimes there really is a civic mindedness in the part of people that open local businesses, and part of their aim is to make an improvement in their community. And so if they open up a second business, it may well kind of follow their own successful model, which is having a neighborhood business. Here in Minneapolis, we have a local chain. Of course, we have Caribou, a big national chain, is based here. And of course, there's Starbucks all over the place. But there are 1,000,001 independent coffee houses in town, too. But there's also a local chain called Dunn Brothers. And they maybe have 30 or 40 coffee shops now. But each Dunn Brothers that you walk into has a very much a feel of that place they're in. There's not a cookie cutter design. They're sometimes they're bigger, sometimes they're smaller. The ones in the suburbs have a drive through, but the ones in the city are very much kind of storefront businesses. For me, I think the coffee shop is really the symbol of the local business revival. I mean, in cities I visit, there seems to be just this wonderful, wonderful overflowing of new coffee shops. And usually in urban neighborhoods, they tend to be kind of an independent business that has kind of a funky atmosphere to it. And you can really see that this is a place where neighbors are kind of running into each other. And I think without them, it's maybe what the corner bar was two generations ago or something. But it's really, where everybody knows your name, as they said on Cheers.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm sympathetic to your point, but yeah. Doesn't the same thing happen in Starbucks?
I think it does. I think it does. And it's not necessarily, you know, and actually in our book, we give credit to Starbucks as being a little bit of an inspiration role model for a lot of independent coffee shops. The way it is here in the Twin Cities is that the Starbucks tend to dominate in the suburban areas, and they tend to dominate kind of in the downtown areas, which are basically your more high-rent areas. And then off in the neighborhoods, it's the independent coffee shops that prevail. And I think that's true with a lot of different sectors.
Jay Waljasper, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Yeah, thanks, Carol.
Jay Waljasper is author of the great neighborhood book, A Do-It-Yourself Guide to Placemaking. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. This week's City Views commentator Walker Smith talks about the importance of raising the bar.
There is nothing harder for me to do than stare at a blank page and put my thoughts down on paper. Some people come by this naturally. Words fill up the page for them with ease. I labor over every word and dread the process of starting anew when more writing comes due. A mere 500 words, about one double-spaced page and a half, the length of this commentary, takes me less than 4 minutes to read, yet over 4 hours to write. In my defense, though, 500 words are not as few as it sounds. A typical news story in a newspaper is about that long, plus or minus 100 words. Andy Rooney's commentaries on 60 Minutes are rarely more than 400 words long and sometimes as few as 300. The Gettysburg Address, as inscribed on the wall of the Lincoln Memorial, is a mere 266 words long. If you write 500 words, you better have something to say, because a lot of important things have been said in a lot fewer words. Honestly, I can't say that these City Views commentaries always measure up to that standard, but for 4 hours at a time, I try. At the very least, the process of careful, deliberate writing, however difficult and slow, forces me to be more thoughtful, which helps me develop ideas and opinions that are far better than the ones I started with originally. I know I can't produce a winning commentary every time, but that's what I'm shooting for, and I don't mind holding myself up to the impossible standard of other smarter people who talk less but say more. A higher standard may be out of reach, but it provides the one true measure against which to guide our actions and gauge our success. Not just in writing, but in everything we do. It is no excuse to settle for less because that's the norm or because perfection is unattainable. Only in terms of a higher standard, something for which we must stretch ourselves to even come close, can we take proper stock of our lives. How we behave, how we deal with others, how we manage our affairs should aspire to something better. Otherwise, we settle for what's convenient and easy. Excellence, not expediency, must be our constant guide if we are to advance ourselves and ensure our legacy. This is true no less of us as a nation than it is of us as individual people. Above all else, America is an idea and an uncompromising commitment to the best that people can be. America is an example that has inspired the world. We must not abandon the principles that have long been the higher standards against which we have judged ourselves and our progress. There has never been a lack of reasons to turn our backs on what's hard to live up to in favor of what's easy and opportune to do. Lately, there seem to be more reasons than ever. But we mustn't let fear overtake smarts, courage, and integrity. We must avoid the temptation to excuse ourselves from what is now and has always been hard and risky, even life-threatening. When we quit reaching for higher standards no matter what, we lose the spur that makes us better, even when we fall short. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. His new book, Generation Ageless, will be in stores October 2nd. Walker comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders who just released the new report, Kids in Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.